A new friend. Nell sees a real horse. A ride through Dovetail. Nell and Harve are separated. The person on the horse was not Brad. It was a woman Nell and Harve didn't know. She had straight, reddish-blonde hair, pale skin with thousands of freckles, and carrot-colored eyebrows and eyelashes that were almost invisible except when the sun grazed her face. "I'm a friend of Brad's," she said. "He's at work. Does he know you?" Nell was about to pipe up, but Harve shushed her with a hand on her arm and gave the woman a somewhat more abridged version than Nell might have provided. He mentioned that Brad had been a friend of their mother's for a while, that he had always treated them kindly and had actually taken them to the NAC to see the horses. Not far into the story, the blank expression on the woman's face was replaced by one that was somewhat more guarded, and she stopped listening. "I think Brad told me about you once," she finally said when Harve had wandered into a blind alley. "I know he remembers you. So what is it that you would like to happen now?" This was a poser. Nell and Harve had settled into a habit of concentrating very strongly on what they would like not to happen. They were baffled by options, which to them seemed like dilemmas. Harve left off clutching Nell's arm and took her hand instead. Neither of them said anything. "Perhaps," Constable Moore finally said, after the woman had turned to him for a cue, "it would be useful for the two of you to set a while in some safe, quiet place and gather your thoughts." "That would do nicely, thank you," Nell said. "Dovetail contains many public parks and gardens." "Forget it," the woman said, knowing her cue when she heard it. "I'll take them back to the mill house until Brad gets home. Then," she said significantly to the constable, "we'll figure something out." The woman stepped out of the gatehouse briskly, not looking back at Nell and Harve. She was tall and wore a pair of loose khaki trousers, much worn at the knees but hardly at all in the seat, and splotched here and there with old, unidentifiable stains. Above that, she wore a very loose Irish fisherman's sweater, sleeves rolled up and safety pinned to form a dense woolen torus orbiting each of her freckled forearms, the motif echoed by a whorl of cheap silver bangles on each wrist. She was muttering something in the direction of her horse, an Appaloosa mare who had already swung her neck down and begun to nuzzle at the disappointingly close-cropped grass inside the fence, looking for a blade or two that had not been marked by the assiduous corgis. When she stopped to stroke the mare's neck, Nell and Harve caught up with her and learned that she was simply giving a simplified account of what had just happened in the gatehouse and what was going to happen now, all delivered rather absent-mindedly, just in case the mare might want to know. For a moment, Nell thought that the mare might actually be a chevaline dressed up in a fake horse skin, but then it ejected a stream of urine the dimensions of a fence post, glittering like a lightsaber in the morning sun and clad in a torn cloak of steam, and Nell smelled it and knew the horse was real. The woman did not mount the horse, which she had apparently ridden bareback, but took its reins as gently as if they were cobwebs and led the horse on. Nell and Harve followed, a few paces behind, and the woman walked across the green for some time, apparently organizing things in her mind, before finally tucking her hair behind her ear on one side and turning toward them. "Did Constable Moore talk to you about rules at all?" "What rules?" Harve blurted, before Nell could get into it in a level of detail that might have cast a negative light on them. Nell marveled for the 100th time at her brother's multifarious trickiness, which would have done Peter himself proud. "We make things," the woman said, as if this provided a nearly perfect and sufficient explanation of the file called Dovetail. "Brad makes horseshoes, but Brad's the exception because mostly he provides services relating to horses. Doesn't he, Eggshell?" the woman added for the mare's benefit. "That's why he had to live down in the LT for a while, because there was a disagreement as to whether grooms, butlers, and other service providers fit in with Dovetail's charter. But we had a vote and decided to let them in. This is boring you, isn't it?" "My name's Rita, and I make paper."
"You mean in the MC?"
This seemed like an obvious question to Nell, but Rita was surprised to hear it and eventually laughed it off.
"I'll show you later. But what I was getting at is that, unlike where you've been living, everything here at Dovetail was made by hand. We have a few matter compilers here, but if we want a chair, say, one of our craftsmen will put it together out of wood, just like in ancient times."
"Why don't you just compile it?" Harve said. "The MC can make wood."
"It can make fake wood," Rita said, "but some people don't like fake things." Why don't you like fake things? Nell asked.
Rita smiled at her.
It's not just us, it's them, she said, pointing up the mountain toward the belt of high trees that separated Dovetail from New Atlantis territory.
Light dawned on Harv's face.
The Vickies buy stuff from you, he said.
Rita looked a little surprised, as if she'd never heard them called Vickies before.
Anyway, what was I getting at? Oh, yeah, the point is that everything here is unique, so you have to be careful with it.
Nell had a rough idea of what unique was, but Harv didn't, and so Rita explained it for a while as they walked through Dovetail.
At some length, it dawned on both Nell and Harv that Rita was actually trying to tell them, in the most bewilderingly circumspect way imaginable, that she didn't want them to run around and break stuff. This approach to child behavior modification was so at odds with everything they knew that, in spite of Rita's efforts to be pleasant, the conversation was blighted by confusion on the children's part and frustration on hers. From time to time, her freckles vanished as her face turned red. Where Dovetail had streets, they were paved with little blocks of stone laid close together. The vehicles were horses, chevalines, and velocipedes with fat, knobby tires. Except for one spot where a number of buildings clustered together around a central green, houses were widely spaced and tended to be very small or very large. All of them seemed to have nice gardens, though. And from time to time, Nell would dart off the road to smell a flower. At first, Rita would watch her nervously, telling her not to pick any of the flowers as they belonged to other people. At the end of a road was a wooden gate with a laughably primitive latch, consisting of a sliding plank, glossy with use. Past the gate, the road became a very rough mosaic of flagstones with grass growing between them. It wound between undulating pastures where horses and the occasional dairy cow grazed, and eventually terminated at a great three-story stone building perched on the bank of a river that ran down the mountain from the New Atlantis clave. A giant wheel grew out of the side of the building and spun slowly as the river pushed on it. A man stood outside before a large chopping block, using a hatchet with an exceptionally wide blade to split thin wedges of red wood from a log. These were piled into a wicker basket that was hauled up on a rope by a man who stood on the roof, replacing some of the old gray shingles with these new red ones. Harv was paralyzed with wonder at this exhibition and stopped walking. Nell had seen much of the same sort of process at work in the pages of her primer. She followed Rita over to a long, low building where the horses lived. Most of the people did not live in the mill house proper, but in a couple of long outbuildings, two stories each, with workshops below and living quarters above. Nell was a little surprised to see that Rita did not actually live with Brad. Her apartment and her shop were each twice the size of Nell's old flat, and filled with fine things of heavy wood, metal, cotton, linen, and porcelain that, as Nell was beginning to understand, had all been made by human hands, probably right here in Dovetail. Rita's shop had great kettles where she would brew thick, fibrous stew. She spread the stew thinly over screens to draw out the water and flattened it with a great hand-cranked press to make paper, thick and rough-edged and subtly colored from the thousands of tiny fibers wending through it. When she had a stack of paper made, she would take it next door to a shop with a sharp, oily smell, where a bearded man with a smudged apron would run it through another big hand-cranked machine. When it came out of this machine, it had letters on the top, giving the name and address of a lady in New Atlantis. Since Nell had been decorous so far, and not tried to stick her fingers into the machinery, and not driven anyone to distraction with her questions, Rita gave her leave to visit some of the other shops, as long as she asked permission at each one. Nell spent most of the day making friends with various shop owners. A glassblower, a jeweler, a cabinet maker, a weaver, even a toy maker, who gave her a tiny wooden doll in a calico dress. Harv spent a while bothering the men who were putting shingles on the roof, then wandered about in the fields for most of the day, kicking small rocks from place to place, generally scoping out the boundaries and general condition of the community centered on the mill house. Nell checked in on him from time to time. At first he looked tense and skeptical, then he relaxed and enjoyed it, and finally, late in the afternoon, he became surly and perched himself on a boulder above the running stream, tossing pebbles into it, chewing his thumbnail, and thinking. Brad came home early, riding a bay stallion straight down the mountain from the New Atlantis clave, angling through the green belt and piercing the dog pod grid with scant consequences, as the authorities knew him.
Harve approached him with a formal mien, harrumphing phlegm out of the way as he prepared to offer up an explanation and a plea. But Brad's eyes merely glanced over Harve, settled on Nell, appraised her for a moment, then looked away shyly. The verdict was that they could stay the night, but all else depended on legal niceties that were beyond his powers. "Have you done anything the Shanghai police might find interesting?" Brad asked Harve gravely. Harve said no, a simple no, without the usual technicalities, provisos, and subclauses. Nell wanted to tell Brad everything, but she had been noticing how, in the primer, whenever someone asked Peter Rabbit a direct question of any kind, he always lied. "To look at our green fields and big houses, you might think we're on Atlantis turf here," Brad said. "But we're under Shanghai jurisdiction just like the rest of the lease territories. Now, usually the Shanghai police don't come around, because we are peaceable folk, and because we've made certain arrangements with them. But if it were known that we were harboring runaway gang members..." "Nuff said," Harve blurted. It was clear that he had already worked all of this out in his head as he sat on the riverbank, and was only waiting for the adults to catch up with his logic. Before Nell understood what was going on, he came up to her and gave her a hug and a kiss on the lips. Then he turned away from her and began running across a green field down toward the ocean. Nell ran after him, but she could not keep up. And finally she fell down in a sand of bluebells and watched Harve dissolve into a curtain of tears. When she could no longer see him, she curled up sobbing. And in time, Rita came and gathered her up in her strong arms and carried her slowly back across the field to the mill house, where the steady wheel rolled.
Orphans of the Han are exposed to the benefits of modern educational technology. Judge Fang reflects on the fundamental precepts of Confucianism.
The orphanage ships had built-in matter compilers, but they could not, of course, be hooked up to sources. Instead, they drew their supplies of matter from cubical containers, rather like tanks of atoms arranged very precisely. These containers could be loaded on board with cranes and hooked up to the matter compilers in the same way that feed lines would be if they resided on shore. The ships put into Shanghai frequently, offloaded empty containers, and took new ones on board. Their hungry populations were fed almost exclusively on synthetic rice produced by the matter compilers. There were 7 ships now. The first 5 had been named after the master's 5 virtues, and after that they had taken to naming them after major Confucian philosophers. Judge Fang flew out to the one named, as best as it could be translated into English, Generosity of Soul, personally carrying the MC program in the sleeve of his garment. This was the very ship he had visited on the eventful night of his boat ride with Dr. X. And ever since then, he had somehow felt closer to these 50,000 little mice than any of the other 250,000 in the other vessels. The program was written to work in a bulk compiler, extruding dozens of primers each cycle. When the first batch was finished, Judge Fang plucked out one of the new volumes, inspected its cover, which had the appearance of marbled jade, flipped through the pages admiring the illustrations, and cast a critical eye over the calligraphy. Then he carried it down a corridor and into a playroom where a few hundred little mice were running around blowing off steam. He caught the eye of one girl and beckoned her over. She came reluctantly, chivied along by an energetic teacher who alternated between smiling to the girl and bowing to the judge. He squatted so that he could look her in the eye and handed her the book. She was much more interested in the book than in Judge Fang, but she had been taught the proper formalities and bowed and thanked him. Then she opened it up. Her eyes got wide. The book began to talk to her. To Judge Fang, the voice sounded a bit dull, the rhythm of the speech not exactly right. But the girl didn't care. The girl was hooked. Judge Fang stood up to find himself surrounded by 100 little girls, all facing toward the little jade book, standing on tiptoes, mouths open. Finally, he had been able to do something unambiguously good with his position. In the coastal republic, it wouldn't have been possible. In the Middle Kingdom, which hewed to the words and spirit of the master, it was simply part of his duties. He turned and left the room. None of the girls noticed, which was just as well, as they might have seen a quiver in his lip and a tear in his eye. As he made his way through the corridors toward the upper deck, where his airship awaited him, he reviewed for the 1,000th time the great learning, the kernel of the master's thought. the ancients who wished to demonstrate illustrious virtue throughout the kingdom first ordered well their own states. Wishing to order well their states, they first regulated their families. Wishing to regulate their families, they first cultivated their persons. Wishing to cultivate their persons, they first rectified their hearts. Wishing to rectify their hearts, they first sought to be sincere in their thoughts. Wishing to be sincere in their thoughts, they first extended to the utmost their knowledge. Such extension of knowledge lay in the investigation of things. From the Son of Heaven down to the mass of the people, all must consider the cultivation of the person the root of everything besides. Ackworth receives an ambiguous message. A ride through Vancouver. Tattooed woman and totem poles. He enters the hidden world of the drummers. Kidnapper had a glove compartment of sorts hollowed into the back of its neck. As he was riding across the causeway, Hackworth opened it up, because he wanted to see whether it was large enough to contain his bowler without folding, bending, spindling, or mutilating the exquisite hyperboloid of its brim. The answer was that it was just a wee bit too small. But Dr. X had been thoughtful enough to toss in some snacks, a handful of fortune cookies, three of them to be exact. They looked good. Hackworth picked one up and snapped it open. The strip of paper bore some kind of gaudily animated geometric pattern, long strands of something tumbling end over end and bouncing against one another. It looked vaguely familiar. These were supposed to be yarrow stalks, which Taoists use for divination. But instead of forming a hexagram of the I Ching, they began falling into place, one after another, in such a way as to form letters in the pseudo-Chinese typeface used in the logos of one-star Chinese restaurants. When the last one had bounced into place, the fortune read, "Seek the Alchemist." "Thanks ever so much, Dr. X," Hackworth snapped. He continued to watch the fortune for a while, hoping that it would turn into something a little more informative, but it was dead, just a piece of litter now and forever. Kidnapper slowed to a canter and cruised purposefully through the university, then turned north and crossed a bridge into the peninsula that contained most of Vancouver proper. The Chevaline did a perfectly good job of not stepping on anyone, and Hackworth soon learned to stop worrying and trust its instincts. This left his eyes free to wander through the sights of Vancouver, which had not been advisable when he'd come this way on the velocipede. He had not noticed before the sheer maddening profusion of the place, each person seemingly an ethnic group of one, each with his or her own costume, dialect, sect, and pedigree. It was as if, sooner or later, every part of the world became India, and thus ceased to function in any sense meaningful to straight-arrow Cartesian rationalists like John Percival Hackworth, his family, and friends. Shortly after passing the aerodrome, they reached Stanley Park, an unruined peninsula several miles around which had, thank God, been forked over to protocol and kept much as it had always been, with the same Douglas firs and mossy red cedars that had been growing there forever. Hackworth had been here a few times and had a vague idea of how it was laid out. Restaurants here and there, paths along the beach, a zoo and aquarium, public playing fields. Kidnapper took him for a nice lope along a pebbly beach, and then somewhat abruptly bounded up a slope, for that purpose switching into a gait never used by any real horse. Its legs shortened, and it clawed its way sure-footedly up the 45-degree surface like a mountain lion. An alarmingly quick zigzag through a stand of firs brought them into an open grassy area. Then Kidnapper slowed to a mere walk, as if it were a real horse that had to be cooled down gradually, and took Hackworth into a semicircle of old totem poles. A young woman was here, standing before one of the poles with her hands clasped behind her back, which would have given her an endearingly prim appearance if she had not been stark naked and covered with constantly shifting mediatronic tattoos. Even her hair, which fell loosely to her waist, had been infiltrated with some kind of nanosite so that each strand's color fluctuated from place to place, according to a scheme not just now apparent to Hackworth. She was looking intently at the carving of a totem pole, and apparently not for the first time, for her tattoos were done in much the same style. The woman was looking at a totem pole dominated by a representation of an orca, head down and tail up, dorsal fin projecting horizontally out of the pole and evidently carved from a separate piece of wood. The orca's blowhole had a human face carved around it. The face's mouth and the orca's blowhole were the same thing. This promiscuous denial of boundaries was everywhere on the totem poles and on the woman's tattoo. The staring eyes of a bear were also the faces of some other sort of creature. The woman's navel was also the mouth of a human face, much like the orca's blowhole, and sometimes that face became the mouth of a larger face whose eyes were her nipples and whose goatee was her pubic hair. But as soon as he'd made out one pattern, it would change into something else, because unlike the totem poles, the tattoo was dynamic and played with images in time the same way that the totem poles did in space. "Hello, John," she said. "It's too bad I loved you, because you had to leave." Hackworth tried to find her face, which should have been easy, it being the thing in front of her head. But his eyes kept snagging on all the other little faces that came and went and flowed into one another, time-sharing her eyes, her mouth, even her nostrils. And he was starting to recognize patterns in her hair, too, which was much more than he could handle. He was pretty sure he had just caught a glimpse of Fiona in there. She turned her back on him, her hair spinning out momentarily like a twirling skirt, and for that instant he could see through it and begin to make sense of the image. He was positive that somewhere in there he'd seen Gwen and Fiona walking along a beach. He dismounted from Kidnapper and followed her on foot. Kidnapper followed him silently. They walked across the park for half a mile or so, and Hackworth kept his distance because when he got too close to her, the images in her hair bewildered his eyes. She took him to a wild stretch of beach where immense Douglas fir logs lay scattered around. As Hackworth clambered over the logs, trying to keep up with the woman, he occasionally caught a handhold that appeared to have been carved by someone long ago. The logs were palimpsests. Two of them rose from the water's edge, not quite vertical, stuck like darts into the impermanent sand. Hackworth walked between them, the surf crashing around his knees. He saw weathered intimations of faces and wild beasts living in the wood, ravens, eagles, and wolves tangled into organic skeins. The water was bitterly cold on his legs, and he whooped in a couple of breaths, but the woman kept walking. The water was up past her waist now, and her hair was floating around her so that the translucent images once again became readable. Then she vanished beneath a collapsing wave 2 meters high. The wave knocked Hackworth on his backside and washed him along for a short distance, flailing his arms and legs. When he got his balance back, he sat there for a few moments, letting smaller waves embrace his waist and chest, waiting for the woman to come up for a breath. But she didn't. There was something down there. He rolled up onto his feet and tramped straight into the ocean. Just as the waves were coming up into his face, his feet contacted something hard and smooth that gave way beneath him. He was sucked downward as the water plunged into a subterranean void. A hatch slammed shut above his head, and suddenly he was breathing air again. The light was silver. He was sitting in water up to his chest, but it rapidly drained away, drawn off by some kind of a pumping system, and then he found himself looking down a long, silvery tunnel. The woman was descending it, a stone's throw ahead of him. Hackworth had been in a few of these, normally in more industrial settings. The entrance was dug into the beach, but the rest of it was a floating tunnel, a tube full of air moored to the bottom. It was a cheap way to make space. The Nipponese used these things as sleeping quarters for foreign guest workers. The walls were made of membranes that drew oxygen from the surrounding seawater and ejected carbon dioxide, so that seen from a fish's point of view, the tunnels steamed like hot pasta on a cold steel plate as they excreted countless microbubbles of polluted CO2. These things extruded themselves into the water like the roots that grew out of improperly stored potatoes, forking from time to time, carrying their own feeds forward so that they could be extended on command. They were empty and collapsed to begin with, and when they knew they were finished, they inflated themselves with scavenged oxygen and grew rigid. Now that the cold water had drained out of Hackworth's ears, he could hear a deep drumming that he'd mistaken at first for the crash of the surf overhead. But this had a steadier beat that invited him forward. Down the tunnel Hackworth walked, following the woman, and as he went, the light grew dimmer and the tunnel narrower. He suspected that the walls of the tunnel had mediatronic properties because he kept seeing things from the corner of his eyes that were no longer there when he snapped his head around. He'd assumed that he would soon reach a chamber, a swelling in the tunnel where this woman's friends would sit pounding on enormous kettle drums. But before reaching any such thing, he came to a place where the tunnel had gone completely dark, and he had to crouch to his knees and feel his way along. When he touched the taut but yielding wall of the tunnel with his knees and his hands, he felt the drumming in his bones and realized that audio was built into the stuff. The drumming could be anywhere, or it could be recorded. Or maybe it was a lot simpler than that. Maybe the tubes happened to transmit sound well, and somewhere else in the tunnel system, people were just pounding on the walls. His head contacted the tunnel. He dropped to his belly and began to crawl along. Swarms of tiny sparkling lights kept lunging past his face, and he realized that they were his hands. Light-emitting nanocytes had become embedded in his flesh. They must have been put there by Dr. X's physician, but they had not come alight until he entered these tunnels. If the woman hadn't already come through here, he would have given up at this point, thinking it a dead end, a busted tunnel that had failed to expand. The drumming was now coming into his ears and bones from all sides. He could not see a thing, though from time to time he thought he caught a glimmer of flickering yellow light. The tunnel undulated slightly in the deep currents, rivers of bitterly cold water swirling along the floor of the straits. Whenever he allowed his mind to wander, reminding himself that he was deep below the surface of the ocean here, he had to stop and force himself not to panic. Concentrate on the nice, air-filled tunnel, not what surrounds it. There was definitely light ahead. He found himself in a swelling in the tube, just wide enough to sit up in, and rolled over on his back for a moment to rest. A lamp was burning in here, a bowl filled with some kind of melting hydrocarbon that left no ash or smoke. The mediatronic walls had animated scenes on them, barely visible in the flickering light. Animals dancing in the forest. He followed the tubes for some period of time that was quite long but difficult to estimate. From time to time, he would come to a chamber with a lamp and more paintings. As he crawled through the long, perfectly black tunnels, he began to experience visual and auditory hallucinations. Vague at first, just random noise knocking around in his neural net, but increasingly well-resolved and realistic. The hallucinations had a dreamlike quality, in which things he'd actually seen recently, such as Gwen and Fiona, Dr. X, the airship, the boys playing field ball, were mingled with images so alien he scarcely recognized them. It troubled him that his mind was taking something as dear to him as Fiona and blending her into a farrago of alien sights and ideas. He could see the nanocytes in his skin, but for all he knew, he might have a million more living in his brain now, piggybacking on axons and dendrites, sending data to one another in flashes of light. A second brain intermingled with his own. There was no reason that information could not be relayed from one such nanocyte to another, through his body and outward to the nanocytes in his skin, and from there across the darkness to others. What would happen when he came close to other people with similar infestations? When he finally reached the grand chamber, he could not really tell whether it was reality or another machine-made hallucination. It was shaped like a flattened ice cream cone, a domed ceiling above a gently sloping conical floor. The ceiling was a vast mediatron, and the floor served as an amphitheater. Hackworth spilled into the room abruptly as the drumming reached a crescendo. The floor was slick, and he slid down helplessly until he reached the central pit. He rolled onto his back and saw a fiery scene sprawling across the dome above, and in his peripheral vision, covering the floor of the theater, a thousand living constellations pounding on the floor with their hands. Bred and born in the foreign regions beyond, there is much in the administration of the Celestial Dynasty that is not perfectly comprehensible to the barbarians, and they are continually putting forced constructions on things of which it is difficult to explain to them the real nature. Qi Ying. Part the Second. Hackworth has a singular experience, the Rite of the Drummers. In a cavernous, dark space, lit by many small fires, a young woman, probably not much more than a girl, stands on a pedestal naked except for an elaborate paint job. Or maybe it is a total body mediatronic tattoo. A crown of leafy branches is twined around her head, and she has thick, voluminous hair spreading to her knees. She is clutching a bouquet of roses to her breast, the thorns indenting her flesh. Many people, perhaps thousands, surround her, drumming madly, sometimes chanting and singing. Into the space between the girl and the watchers, a couple of dozen men are introduced. Some come running out of their own accord, some look as if they've been pushed, some wander in as if they've been walking down the street, stark naked, and gone in the wrong door. Some are Asian, some European, some African. Some have to be prodded by frenzied celebrants who charge out of the crowd and shove them here and there. Eventually they form a circle around the girl, and then the drumming builds to a deafening crescendo, speeds up until it devolves into a rhythmless hailstorm, and then suddenly, instantly, stops. Someone wails something in a high, purposeful, ululating voice. Hackworth can't understand what this person is saying. Then there is a single, massive drumbeat. More wailing, another drumbeat. Again. The third drumbeat establishes a ponderous rhythm. This goes on for a while, the beat slowly speeding up. After a certain point, the wailer no longer stops between beats. He begins to weave his rap through the bars in a sort of counterpoint. The ring of men standing around the girl begin to dance in a very simple shuffling motion, one way and then the other way around the girl. Hackworth notes that all of them have erections, sheathed in brightly colored mediatronic condoms. Rubbers that actually make their own light, so that the bobbing boners look like so many Sialum wands dancing through the air. The drum beats and the dancing speed up very slowly. The erections tell Hackworth why this is taking so long. He's watching foreplay here. After half an hour or so, the excitement, phallic and otherwise, is unbearable. The beat is now a notch faster than your basic pulse rate, lots of other beats and counter-rhythms woven through it, and the chanting of the individual singer has become a wild, semi-organized choral phenomenon. At some point, after seemingly nothing has happened for half an hour, everything happens at once. The drumming and chanting explode to a new, impossible level of intensity. The dancers reach down, grip the flaccid reservoir tips of their radioactive condoms, stretch them out. Someone runs out with a knife and cuts off the tips of the condoms in a freakish parody of circumcision, exposing the glands of each man's penis. The girl moves for the first time, tossing her bouquet up in the air like a bride making her move toward the limo. The roses fountain, spinning end over end, and come down individually among the dancers, who snatch them out of the air, scrabble for them on the floor, whatever. The girl faints or something, falling backward, arms out, and is caught by several of the dancers, who hoist her body up over their heads and parade her around the circle for a while, like a crucified body just crowbarred off the tree. She ends up flat on her back on the ground, and one of the dancers is between her legs, and in a very few thrusts he has finished. A couple of others grab his arms and yank him out of there before he's even had a chance to tell her he'll still love her in the morning. And another one is in there, and he doesn't take very long either. All this foreplay has got these guys in hair-trigger mode. The dancers manage to rotate through in a few minutes. Hackworth can't see the girl, who's completely hidden, but she's not struggling as far as he can tell, and they don't seem to be holding her down. Toward the end, smoke or steam or something begins to spiral up from the middle of the orgy. The last participant grimaces even more than the average person who's having an orgasm and yanks himself back from the woman, grabbing his dick and hopping up and down and hollering in what looks like pain. That's the signal for all of the dancers to jump back away from the woman, who is now kind of hard to make out, just a fuzzy, motionless package wrapped in steam. Flames erupt from several locations, all over her body, at once, seams of lava splitting open along her veins, and the heart itself erupting from her chest like ball lightning. Her body becomes a burning cross, spread out on the floor, the bright apex of an inverted cone of turbulent steam and smoke. Hackworth notices that the drumming and chanting have completely stopped. The crowd observes a long moment of silence while the body burns. Then, when the last of the flames have died out, an honor guard of sorts descends from the crowd. Four men in black body paint with white skeletons painted on top of that. He notes that the woman was lying on a square sheet of some kind when she burned. Each of the guys grabs a corner of the sheet. Her remains tumble into the center, powdery ash flies, flecks of red-hot coals spark. The skeleton men carry the remains over to a 50-gallon steel drum and dump it in. There's a burst of steam and lots of sizzling noises as the hot coals contact some kind of liquid that was in the drum. One of the skeleton men picks up a long spoon and gives the mix a stir, then dips a cracked and spalled University of Michigan coffee mug into it and takes a long drink. The other three skeleton men each drink in their turn. By now, the spectators have formed a long queue. One by one, they step forward. The leader of the skeleton men holds the mug for them, gives each one a sip. Then they all wander off, individually or in small conversing groups. Show's over. Nell's life at Dovetail. Developments in the primer. A trip to the New Atlantis clave. She is presented to Miss Matheson. New lodgings with an old acquaintance. Nell lived in the mill house for several days. They gave her a little bed under the eaves on the top floor, in a cozy place only she was tiny enough to reach. She had her meals with Rita or Brad, or one of the other nice people she knew there. During the days, she would wander in the meadow, or dangle her feet in the river, or explore the woods, sometimes going as far as the dog pod grid. She always took the primer with her. Lately, it had been filled with the doings of Princess Nell and her friends in the city of King Magpie. It kept getting more like a racketive and less like a story, and by the end of each chapter she was exhausted from all the cleverness she had expended just to get herself and her friends through another day without falling into the clutches of pirates or of King Magpie himself. In time, she and Peter came up with a very tricky plan to sneak into the castle, create a diversion, and seize the magic books that were the source of King Magpie's power. This plan failed the first time, but the next day, Nell turned the page back and tried it again, this time with a few changes. It failed again, but not before Princess Nell and her friends had gotten a little farther into the castle. The sixth or seventh time, the plan worked perfectly. While King Magpie was locked in the Battle of Riddles with Peter Rabbit, which Peter won, Purple used a magic spell to smash open the door to his secret library, which was filled with books even more magical than the young lady's illustrated primer. Hidden inside one of those books was a jeweled key. Princess Nell took the key, and Purple made off with several of King Magpie's magic books while she was at it. They made a breathtaking escape across a river into the next country, where King Magpie could not chase them, and camped in a nice meadow for a few days, resting. During the daytime, when the others were just stuffed animals, Princess Nell would peruse some of the new magic books that Purple had stolen. When she did, its image in the illustration would zoom toward her until it filled the page, and then the primer itself would become that magical book until she decided to put it away. Nell's favorite book was a magical atlas, which she could use to explore any land, real or imaginary. During the nighttime, Purple spent most of her time reading a very large, crusty, worn, stained, burnt tome entitled Pantechnicon. This book had a built-in hasp with a padlock. Whenever Purple wasn't using it, she locked it shut. Nell asked to see it a few times, but Purple told her she was too young to know such things as were written in this book. During this time, Duck, as usual, made herself busy around the camp, tidying up and fixing their meals, doing laundry on the rocks by the river, and mending their clothes that had become ragged during their wanderings. Peter became restless. He was quick with words, but he had not learned the trick of reading, and so the books from King Magpie's library were of no use to him, save as nest-lining material. He got into the habit of exploring the surrounding forests, particularly the ones to the north. At first he would be gone for a few hours at a time, but once he stayed away all night and did not come back until the following noon. Then he began to go on trips for several days at a time. Peter vanished into the north woods one day, staggering under a heavy pack, and didn't come back at all. Nell was in the meadow one day gathering flowers when a fine lady, a Vicky, came riding toward her on a horse. When she drew closer, Nell was surprised to see that the horse was Eggshell, and that the lady was Rita, all dressed up in a long dress like the Vicky ladies wore, with a riding hat on her head, and riding side saddle of all things.
"You look pretty," Nell said.
"Thank you, Nell," Rita said. "Would you like to look like this too for a little while? I have a surprise for you." One of the ladies who lived in the mill house was a milliner, and she had made Nell a dress, sewing it all together by hand. Rita had brought this dress with her, and she helped Nell change into it right there in the middle of the meadow. Then she braided Nell's hair and even tucked some tiny wildflowers into it. Finally, she helped Nell climb up on top of Eggshell with her and began riding back toward the mill house.
"You will have to leave your book here today," Rita said.
"Why?"
"I'm taking you through the grid, into New Atlantis Clave," Rita said. "Constable Moore told me that I should not, on any account, allow you to carry your book through the grid. He said it would only stir things up. I know you're about to ask me why, Nell, but I don't have an answer."
Nell ran upstairs, tripping over her long skirts a couple of times, and left the primer in her little nook. Then she climbed back on Eggshell with Rita. They rode over a little stone bridge above the water wheel and through the woods, until Nell could hear the faint afflatus of the security aerostats. Eggshell slowed to a walk and pushed gingerly through the field of shiny hovering teardrops. Nell even reached out and touched one, then snapped her hand back, even though it hadn't done anything except push back. The reflection of her face slithered backward across the surface of this pod as they went by. They rode across the territory of New Atlantis for some time without seeing anything other than trees, wildflowers, brooks, the occasional squirrel or deer.
"Why do the Vickies have such a big clave?" Nell asked.
"Don't ever call them Vickies," Rita said.
"Why?"
"It's a word that people who don't like them use to describe them in kind of a bad, unfriendly way," Rita said.
"Like a pejorative term," Nell said.
Rita laughed, more nervous than amused.
"Exactly. Why do the Atlantans have such a big clave?"
"Well, each file has a different way, and some ways are better suited to making money than others, so some have a lot of territory and others don't."
"What do you mean, a different way?"
"To make money, you have to work hard, to live your life in a certain way. The Atlantans all live that way. It's part of their culture. The Nipponese, too. So the Nipponese and the Atlantans have as much money as all the other files put together."
"Why aren't you an Atlantan?"
"Because I don't want to live that way. All the people in Dovetail like to make beautiful things. To us, the things that the Atlantans do, dressing up in these kinds of clothes, spending years and years in school, are irrelevant. Those pursuits wouldn't help us make beautiful things, you see. I'd rather just wear my blue jeans and make paper."
"But the MC can make paper," Nell said.
"Not the kind that the Atlantans like."
"But you make money from your paper only because the Atlantans make money from working hard," Nell said.
Rita's face turned red, and she said nothing for a little while. Then, in a tight voice, she said,
"Nell, you should ask your book the meaning of the word discretion."
They came across a riding trail dotted with great mounds of horse manure and began following it uphill. Soon the trail was hemmed in between dry stone walls, which Rita said that one of her friends in Dovetail had made. Forests gave way to pastures, then lawns like jade glaciers, and great houses on hilltops surrounded by geometric hedges and ramparts of flowers. The trail became a cobblestone road that adopted new lanes from time to time as they rode into town. The mountain kept rising above them for some distance, and on its green summit, half veiled behind a thin cloud layer, Nell could see Source Victoria. From down in the leased territories, the New Atlantis clave had always looked clean and beautiful, and it was certainly those things. But Nell was surprised at how cool the weather was here compared to the LT. Rita explained that the Atlantans came from northern countries and didn't care for hot weather, so they put their city high up in the air to make it cooler. Rita turned down a boulevard with a great flowery park running down the middle. It was lined with red stone row houses with turrets and gargoyles and beveled glass everywhere. Men in top hats and women in long dresses strolled, pushed perambulators, rode horses or chevalines. Shiny, dark green robots, like refrigerators tipped over on their sides, hummed down the street at a toddler's walking pace, squatting over piles of manure and inhaling them. From place to place, there was a messenger on a bicycle or an especially fancy personage in a black, full-lane car.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this